This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 353. Apple, really? Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a beautiful Friday with my friend and co-host, Andy Piper, to talk games, work, and technology at gamesatwork.biz. Andy, how are you?
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I am doing okay this week, thanks. Yes, it's been another pretty quiet week as we ease into 2022. After all of the stresses in the past, it's quite nice to have a couple of slightly quieter but still productive weeks, I think. We're missing our friend Mr. Michael Martin for a couple of weeks, I think. So it's just the two of us to cover off all of the topics. But I'm looking forward to hanging out, seeing what's new, hearing your opinions of the new things.
Yep. And what is new is Steam Deck. Steam Deck says, or Valve says, the Steam Deck is on track to ship.
Yes.
Didn't it delay from last year?
It did. It was supposed to ship before the end of the year, and then they announced, I think, sort of October time, if I remember rightly, that they were going to push it out. Or maybe, November. It does say on the its first line in the article, second word of the article, November. They said it, they were going to push it out. And they're hoping now to get the ball rolling, the machine steamed up, the steam engine running. I don't know how.
They got to keep putting the coal in, right, and adding the water, right?
So they're looking to do it by the end of February. I've read a few more developer reports actually in the last week or so in terms of like hands-on with the machine, but they can't say certain things as specific. It was quite a funny story. I'm going to see if I can find it while we're speaking.
So they're not allowed to say the words good or bad, right?
it was more specific to like, couldn't comment on like what a particular aspect of the interface was like, for example. But yeah, there was
pull downs. Not allowed to talk about pull downs. No pull downs allowed. Well, it's interesting because I know you actually placed an order for this early on, and I was really, when I saw the article this week, I was excited, going, I'm sure Andy's getting ready. He's getting excited, and I was wondering where you stood on your order. Are you that February person?
I don't think I'm on the February one. I remember the day when it all came out, and there were so many of us were trying to mash the buttons to get through to the order page, and I did eventually do it, but it took ages, and I think I'm somewhere in the middle of the pack. So I've just been on the page, the order page, and it's saying Q2 2022, but if you look at some of the other models, they're talking about end of Q2. So I think I'm still sort of relatively up front, but not an early bird, if I can't remember exactly how they
So by Q2, we're not talking like June 32nd.
Right, exactly.
We're talking sometime between April 1st and June 30th, the actual Q2 dates.
Right. So I've just found a story on boilingsteam.com about them interviewing a developer who's under NDA. So they asked a few questions, but there are some things that they can't comment on. I'm just going down the list and seeing specifically
like,
what.
If it's like most NDAs, those things that you can't comment on are like all of it.
What's the desktop?
Like even the fact that you're under NDA.
What's the desktop experience like? I.e., if you're going to run Windows or something else instead of SteamOS, how do you access it? Is it plausible as a daily driver? The answer is it's a good experience. Can't comment on how it's accessed. It can be a daily driver, though I wouldn't recommend it. So there's some weird bits, you know, just the very specific things that they're not able to talk about.
Interesting. Well, it'll be interesting to see sometime in February. Actually, it says end of February.
Yeah, so it could be the 29th.
So I assume.
So.
Yeah, or the 30th of February, right? I mean, to really make sure that you don't even think about leap year. But yeah, so probably March 1st we'll start seeing all the early bird reviews coming out of people who actually are allowed to talk about that. And I can't wait to see. You know, there's games that I play on Steam that I enjoy. The one thing that drives me, I won't say drives me nuts, an annoyance I have with Steam is I have two different Steam accounts somehow.
Okay.
One for my Mac-based Steam games and one for my Windows-based Steam games.
Right.
Don't ask me how I did that, but I don't know if that was required or if I just screwed up. But either way, it's the case. And so many of my Mac-based Steam games don't run anymore because they were 32-bit.
Really?
And
right.
They never updated them.
So I just...
they never updated them.
I actually bought a game on Steam this week on my M1 Mac. Of course, it's running under Rosetta. But it's Tiny Rogue, which has been out for a while, but Tiny Rogue 2 has just come out. It's a roguelike, i.e. it's, you know, it's a repeatedly auto-generated dungeon and randomly differently done every time. You die often. But one of the funny things with this is, you know, there's a generation system. So, you know, you go in as the successor to the previous hero. In each adventure, and each one of the
Rogue the 45th.
Well, also each one of the characters has got a number of deficiencies. So, for example, there was one where I can't remember the name of the character, but they were short-sighted. So, you know, they couldn't see as far on the screen ahead. It was kind of got blurry further to the right on the screen as you moved across the screen. There's other issues they have, like, you know, can only hit with very weak weapons or something, you know, because they're not very strong.
So you can hit really hard with a bamboo sword.
Or something like that, yeah, exactly. So
very cool.
That was fun.
I
played it a little bit. It was fun. Rogue. It wasn't very Tiny cool. Rogue, I'm sorry. It was Rogue Legacy, just in case anybody goes looking for that game.
Well, that changes it completely.
Does change it significantly. I think I have a feeling that Tiny Rogue is actually a card game I was looking at this week in relation to Rogue Legacy.
Well, you know, the other thing, the other big news that I remember seeing early this week, and I think you had seen it from a different perspective, was the story of Apple's private Relay being blocked.
Relay? Right? Really?
Really? Gee, we could almost come up with a show title there.
No. Yeah, so the story I saw, I think it was just coming out of the weekend, if I remember rightly, was that a bunch of operators in Europe had written to the European Commission saying that it was, you know, a threat to their ability to manage their networks and innovate and all these things. And a lot of the European carriers either are the parent companies of UK carriers or vice versa or whatever. There's you know, there's going to be some repercussion whether or not the UK is still part of the EU in terms of the networks, but also in terms of, I think, the broader picture, because then later in the week, I think maybe the day after, this broadened out into this is not working already in different places.
Right, because in the US, it was T-Mobile that supposedly was actively blocking Apple's private Relay for the same exact reasons, right? You know, that it would lessen their ability to manage their network. What's funny, if I remember correctly, and I could be completely wrong with this, but I believe, isn't Deutsche Telekom and T-Mobile, aren't they related?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that corporate hierarchy around the globe type situation, right? So the comment is it was being disabled when you upgraded to the latest iOS, right? Or iCloud settings, because they were blocking it for these reasons. And, you know, the beginning of the week or over the weekend as this all started playing out, there was a big hue and cry of, you know, that's not right, that's not fair, blah, 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 blah. Just a couple of days after that, supposedly the major U.S. carriers, so Verizon, AT&T, Mobile, AT&T and T-Mobile, not AT&T, T-Mobile, too many T's in a row there, say, well, no, we're not blocking it. The next day, Apple came out with a clarification saying there was a bug where it was being disabled. However, it still sounds like all the carriers are still fighting to disable it or not allow it for this reason of, you know, managing their networks.
Mm.
Now, you and I talked about this when I first looked at Private Relay over the summer during WWDC, and I found there were things about it that I did not like.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I run a pie hole in the house,
mm-hmm.
To stop ads, tracking and ads and a bunch of other stuff. And whenever I enabled Private Relay,
yeah, that's right, I remember.
It bypassed my pie hole.
We spoke about this on the show.
I actually raised a defect,
mm-hmm.
during the beta test saying, hey, wait a minute, you're breaking my pie hole by doing this, and that's, you know, internal to my personal network. Matter of fact, in my corporate world, the VPN that we use disables Private Relay, or at least bypasses it.
Right.
Because it's capturing the information for it to do its own privatization or obfuscation of my data, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what's funny is, as this week has been playing out, on is it being blocked? Well, the short answer is yes, there are things that block it. I know that for a fact. My pie hole tries and fails, and my pie hole tries to do blocking and it can't because Private Relay does it. And for work, it's the exact opposite. Work blocks it from working. And so what you end up with is there's a play going on here.
Right.
Which I think comes out in the European stories of the carriers there, which is we as carriers make money off of knowing where you are and where you're going to look at data, right? There's a huge amount of money that businesses make selling information about their users. As a matter of fact, I can't remember if it was Verizon or T-Mobile a few years back was caught with a super cookie. Do you remember that story?
Vaguely.
So the super cookie was basically they had their own cookie that they managed that bypassed all the cookie rules in your browser and everywhere else because it was actually at the carrier level, and they could use that to track your usage of the internet across websites.
Right.
And it persisted.
Right.
And so why would you need that? That's not managing your network. That is to get data about your users. And as a carrier, you already have a lot of data unless it's pre-encrypted before getting on the line, right? And that's what Apple Private Relay does. And what it does is it provides a bit of information to both sides of the equation, right? So as someone browsing the web, I still get content that is location-based,
mm-hmm.
using Private Relay.
Right.
That location, however, can be fine-grained,
right.
or
obfuscated,
loosely
grained. Yeah. So it's not like putting you on the other side of the planet. It's putting you in the in the region of, yeah.
Right. It could be like putting it in my neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
or in my town, or in my county, or in my state, or in my country, right? So different levels of granularity. And it's not that granular that I can program. I can choose like one or two levels. Which means, from a carrier perspective, if I'm worried about balancing my network traffic, those same levels of granularity are quite appropriate enough,
right.
to say, I've got a lot of people accessing this data from North Carolina. Do I really need to take it down to my house upstairs in my office? No, right? North Carolina is probably good enough for most resource balancing, and the city that I'm in is probably well detailed enough for any granularity that they need, or the neighborhood, right? And so what it appears to be, my opinion,
mm-hmm.
is carriers want more information about their users than Apple's Private Relay provides them. That is not a resource balancing issue.
Well,
that is a behavior of the individual person.
There's one issue. There's one particular comment. There's a number of comments on the Shania in security story that we've got in our links here, and there's a number of them that are sort of, you know, conspiracy theorist, and some of them, and a lot of them are quite cynical, as you're being, to be honest. You know, the statement you just made is, you know, okay, this is, you know, they're not meant in a rude way to you, but, you know, you're being quite cynical, you know, in terms of like, is this really about, you know, data management or network management, or is this about the user data? But one of the things here is also pointing out that as well as this happening, there's the current thing where Google is trying to get Apple to quote unquote stop bullying Android users by making their chat bubbles a different color in iMessage, and basically get Apple to adopt RCS, which is their rich communication standard or services for things. So that's also sort of Google going around the GSM standards around SMS and continuing to marginalize the networks who are trying to, per your suggestion, the argument here is that, is this about the networks just trying to hold their claws onto some relevance other than being dumb pipes?
Well, it's I didn't put any articles in this week or find any from people pinging us on it, but the whole thing about the green bubbles, right, the SMS one, I actually really, really like the fact that people who SMS me are green bubbles instead of blue bubbles, because I get charged for SMS on my phone line. I only get 200 messages a month, and then I get charged 25 cents per message. If you're a green bubble, I ain't talking to you.
So in other words, but again, that's a local thing, right? And I think we've spoken about it this way back in the past. But
yeah.
I think the US are one of the countries where you literally have to receive your own messages, whereas here you pay to send, or you used to have to pay to send them. But these days, first of all, very few people use SMS, and second of all, pretty much all of it is comped into the monthly subscription anyway. So
I could pay like $5 or $6 a month and go to unlimited,
right
but why should I?
Well,
I don't use SMS.
You don't have that option, you know. That's an optional extra. It's just thrown in anyway, because there's no value in that anymore.
Well, the other funny thing is, you know, so my wife's phone is not a smartphone because she doesn't want one. She really can't text on it. She doesn't want to text. And she gets charged for every incoming spam text.
Yeah, yeah, frustrating.
And we can't turn it off. And we've argued with the carrier. They're like, okay, it's disabled. It won't happen again. The next month, somebody texts her, and we get a bill again.
Yeah.
And it's
crazy.
Purely a farce.
Yeah.
Because the net incremental cost to send an individual SMS through this network is zero.
Well,
or vanishingly close to zero.
So let's just cover through this quickly. The end of this, you know, there's a ton of links about who's at fault, whether it's the carriers blocking it, whether there's a bug in iOS. If you follow through the conversation that's unfolded across the course of this week, there's some updates in the latest iOS beta that is going to sort of clarify what's going on from an operating system perspective, whether it's turned on, whether it's part of the plan or cell plan or not. And so on. But, you know, ultimately there's been some confusion here. There is a story, but it's not really clear to me what the story is still, whether it's whether it's fully technical, whether it's fully privacy user data, whether it's, you know, whether it's about marketing, basically, or control or what.
Well, the one point that I'd make is, because I am an Apple user, I do like the privacy aspects. The fact, the way Apple private relay works, nobody sees the end-to-end, not Apple, not the third party that they use for one of the jumps, and not the receiving end. Nobody sees the true end-to-end patterns. Is I've actually found that I am turning it on devices and actually letting more ads show up than I normally had.
I respect...
Because before, I killed them completely.
I respect Apple's public position on privacy. I don't think they are doing as good a job or have as they are have been aiming to specifically around the App Store data collection stuff. I think they've put tools in the hands of users, but I think most users are not going to go anywhere near the app privacy report because it's way too complicated and long. The stories we've seen about the ways in which app developers are, especially big ones, corporate ones that have an interest in the user data, are finding ways to skirt around the rules and continue to collect data and then just not tell the user about it, are particularly bothersome. But I think that's a really complicated technical area as well. So, yeah, I don't know.
I think that's fair.
I agree with you that the end-to-end encryption stuff in general is powerful and good, and a good thing for sure.
Yeah, and I do think that the average user is not going to go through all this stuff. It is in beta right now, so you have to actually actively go in and turn it on. So the average user is not going to turn it on.
It's not in beta anymore.
No, Private Relay is.
Our Private Relay, sorry, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, the app privacy is not. That's mm-hmm. active. But you actually have to turn that on, too.
You do. Yeah.
You actually have to turn on these things.
Yes.
And the average user is not going to turn it on, which is why, as they've coined a long time ago, the tyranny of the default, people just leave it as it is, right?
Just looking at mine now, and Flipboard and Google News have by far been doing the most network activity in the last 7 days on my by orders of magnitude more than my browser Chrome, and Google.com and AmpProject.org are massively the top of my website network activity. Now I do use Chrome as my default browser, which is my choice rather than Safari. But yeah, I'm looking at this and most contacted domains. Google.com, fonts.googleapis.com, googleanalytics.com, DoubleClick, which is Google, and then iTunes in-app check. So, yeah.
Well, it's interesting, and we're not going to turn into a security podcast, but I do remember a story about AMP, right? Because I've enabled AMP services on many of the websites that I maintain, right? Because it was speeding up some of the loading of some of the content. However, AMP also provides the ability for Google to track network usage by people across sites. So that gets around turning off third-party cookies and blah, 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 blah. If it's an AMP site, you've got data that's collectible.
Yeah, I think, they put massive incentives in front of site administrators, creators to use AMP. I don't know what the ultimate end of it all is.
Well, we are going long on that topic, which is what I was hoping for, a good meaty discussion. But let's hit just a couple of more quick links. Going back to the past in this current future of the meta. You like that? Of the meta.
I love it.
There was an interesting article yesterday that Second Life is now joining the discussion of Meta with Philip Rosedale joining back in.
I'd completely missed this, and Ian, our friend Epred, brought it to our attention via a tweet. Although he said, "Oh, well, you were bound to have seen this already," but I hadn't personally. But then, you know, he knows me as Captain Slow, so I am just catching up. it's interesting. Interesting. What's your take on this?
Well, I was going to say the interesting part to me is, Second Life was founded back in 2003. It kind of hit its zenith between 2006 and 2008, right when you and I were very, very active in that space. I heard that at the time, the number of average monthly users was hitting about 1 million. And the current number of active monthly users is about 1 million. So it kind of plateaued and it stayed. It didn't die, right? The thing that I really enjoyed about Second Life at the time was, while it was somewhat closed, it was open enough that we were able to do a lot of integrations with it.
Usually, yeah.
And when we talk about the metaverse and we talked about this the last couple of times it's come up. It's really about interconnectivity, open standards, and being able to integrate across all the different platforms. And so to see that Second Life may once again
have
get a little
life.
Bit of its due and have a second life, exactly, is good to see.
I'm loving just the thought of the fact that it launched in 2003. As you say, we were pretty heavily involved sort of 2006, 7, 8 kind of time frame, I guess. And next year would be 20 years since it started. I remember doing a bunch of IoT, what we now call IoT, but didn't call IoT at the time, integrations with, you know, yep. things like, you know, connected houses in real life that you could have lights switch on if you switch them on in Second Life and vice versa.
Yeah.
All that kind of mirrored stuff.
Almost like a digital twin.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me to see that the Eclipse Foundation now has, you know, entire projects, software projects to implement digital twins, which was something that we were talking about as a concept. But now, you know, you can actually go ahead and build that and take, you know, software off the shelf to go ahead and start to integrate stuff. So, I'm interested in the way this has come about in terms of the fact that Rosedale's been off doing a video VR immersive type stuff, VR project, telepresence, that's right. And then is now coming back from the same project, the same company, the same background to reinvest in Second Life and sort of saying, okay, well, you know, we've got a ton of stuff around telepresence, around head-mounted displays and that kind of thing, immersion, presumably, and this is reading tea leaves that don't exist, they're looking at ways of merging the two or doing things within the two. They're taking people from that project. I think they reference seven, is that right? Seven or eight people, I think they say,
they're actually going to move
on to work on Second Life again. So, yeah.
Well, what I thought was really interesting is when you think about this, one of the great things that Second Life had and High Fidelity, is that his other company?
Yeah.
High Fidelity XR is just a portfolio of patents in this space. And as somebody who holds patents in this space myself, it will be really, really nice to see if they become valuable again.
You sit on that digital gold long enough,
it becomes digital. we do try to get into games on gamesatwork.biz, and Ian did send us another tweet that I really enjoyed about stop boasting about the length of your game.
Yes. This is a PC Gamer article that's talking about the fact that there was a tweet from the Dying Light 2 Twitter account talking about the number of hours needed to fully complete it, which evidently in the case of this game is at least 500 hours, which is a lot of hours.
You know, that's amateur. I mean, I play WoW.
Right. I mean, this is a selling point for a standalone. Is it a single player or is it a? Is it a? It's not an MMO, is it? It's not an MMO.
No, it looks like a third-person shooter.
Yeah.
And you know, Steam recently had for free the multiple Lara Croft games.
I downloaded them all. It wasn't Steam, was it? It was Epic.
Sorry, it was Epic. You're right. Correct. I knew it was one of those services. And I started playing, and it's kind of fun. I was amazed how the graphics and quality of it was really, really cool. Really enjoyed that. But my thing is, after a few hours, I was getting bored.
Yeah, I played a few hours when it first came out of Rise of the, or when I first got free access to Rise of the Tomb Raider. And I think I spent a lot of time, if I remember, stuck in a boat in a cavern and a thing where you had to sort of break the wood to get out from underneath. It was annoying. And I gave up, and I didn't really move on from it. And then I haven't played
the others. So 500 hours of that just doesn't sound like it's very.
Well, the story points out. It's interesting. The story actually calls out one of the Assassin's Creed games as having either becoming chores or just running out of steam before the end. The only one I've fully completed, including the DLC, was Syndicate, which is the London-based one, which was. Brilliant game, really, really fun. But obviously, also I had a local and historical interest in it. But I mean, it's very true.
For me, that was Skyrim. Skyrim. I completed with downloadable content.
Well, of course, the Skyrim board game is now available, but that's a different story.
Huh? Yes, when it gets into the grind mode, that's required to finish stuff. Saying 500 hours to me says there's some grinding in this game, and Interesting. So I'm wondering for our listeners, how long do they give a game before they decide it's a grind, and drop it? Well, the other interesting article was this one from Formula1.com.
Mm. Apparently, if you play games long enough, you can go do it. The thing
do
for
it
real.
For real. Yeah.
Does that just apply
to
driving racing cars, or can it apply to like fighting monsters in dungeons
planes.
As well?
It could that too. Yeah. If you get really good at fighting monsters in dungeon, then you go in the real world, find a dungeon that's replete with monsters and fight them.
Why not?
That's how it works. This is pretty cool. I do not have any Formula One racing games. And I started by, I didn't even read the article. I was just started to watch the video, and I was like, oh my God, that is fantastic looking. I mean, it looked like a real Formula One racing race.
It was pretty entertaining to watch your response to a video of a 5-year-old game on a console before we started the show, because Michael was just like, is this real? Is this a real thing? It's a 5-year-old game.
It was
pretty good.
It was a 5-year-old game. It was pretty impressive. But ultimately, evidently, the guy in the article was a competitive player of that game and is now an actual Formula 2 driver.
I think they prefer to be called esports athletes rather than professional player. I don't know.
I would call him a professional player.
Fair enough.
Because, you might get really big thumbs.
So this is this just to fill in a few of the gaps that we've left here. The 23-year-old from Turkey who competed in a couple of esports series in 2017, 2018, and then partly in 2019, and then did some GT4 racing, and then is now actually moving into... Formula 2 in real life, which is pretty impressive.
I mean that's serious stuff. Very, very, very
also
cool.
I mean he's the first racer from his nation and from the world of simulated racing to step into this kind of a role, so it is pretty impressive to see that go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I would probably say professional simulated racer.
Yes.
Because I'm sure there are other people who do training on simulators and stuff who are professional racers.
I mean, I remember going into the...
Or people who've moved their way up into it.
I went to an Xbox Ambassadors event at the Microsoft store in London and got to play Forza Motorsport 7 whilst being inside an actual... oh, my goodness, what was the model of car? My brain is blanking.
Hugo.
But it was a... no. No, it was phenomenal. And they had it all set up with all of the pneumatics and everything so that you could actually experience driving the car for real. That was really cool.
I can see that with flight simulators, right? People build out those rigs.
Absolutely.
And they
use those for real training.
Very realistic.
Well. They genuinely
absolutely.
Do use those for training. So.
Yeah. And it, you know, just to kind of wrap up the fun games for the show, Michael pinged us a tweet from who is this from? Mr. Doob. which is Prince of Persia running on an Apple Watch.
Well, I mean, Michael's away from the show for a couple of weeks, so I expect this is what he's going to be playing.
Yeah, it really is cool, right?
So this is JavaScript implementation of Prince of Persia. If you send a mail or message with that in the body to yourself, you can play Prince of Persia using on your Apple Watch using touch controls, which is quite terrifying.
And insane.
The game itself is incredibly difficult, even with normal controls. So I'm imagining that you will never get past those first set of spikes.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was looking at it and saying, you know, that's that looks pretty early in the game.
Yeah.
The sample that they're showing on the screen.
Yeah.
So it may not even be the whole game. It may just be the first set of spikes because nobody has made it past.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that was true.
Well, that's about all the time we have for this week over here at gamesatwork.biz. We want to thank you for reaching out to us, dropping us links. Andy, where can people find out more about gamesatwork.biz?
They could go, if they wanted to, they could get a web browser and type in gamesatwork.biz into the address bar and then hit the enter key and wait for that page to load and go find out. They could also follow us on Twitter, gamesatwork_biz. And of course, we're on all of your favorite podcasts and apps and catches, and we honestly genuinely thank you for listening to us every week. It's great to have you with us.
Absolutely. So have a great week coming up this week as we drop these on Monday morning, and we'll be recording a new show next week at gamesatwork.biz.
See ya.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.